You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Sam Durant. He's calling from Los Angeles. Sam, thanks so much for being with me today.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So, Sam, I know you have a show up now. Maybe we should start just talking about that show, what's in it, and how you approached it.
Yeah, I have a show up at the gallery here in Los Angeles, Blum & Poe. It's called Build Therefore Your Own World, which is a quote from Ralph Waldo Emerson. And the exhibition consists of really several sculptures and one sort of large-scale, kind of architectural scale work in their large gallery space.
And so, that must be kind of an exciting show, sorry to interrupt, but then, yeah, what is the large scale? I mean, can you describe that work or what that,
yeah,
how that title integrates with the show?
The main themes in the show are transcendentalism, and the sort of main protagonists in transcendentalism, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Henry David Thoreau, the Alcott sisters, and so on, the abolitionists, Frederick Douglass, for instance, and the sort of politics of race and slavery in 18th and 19th century New England. The main work in the show is a big architectural piece. It contains floorboards from a project I did last year in Concord, Mass. That were transported out to LA, and then we erected them into the walls of a of a house. So you have kind of a freestanding walls, like two side walls and two end walls, not connected, sort of standing in space with no roof. And then on the boards, the horizontally laid in boards of the walls, there's a series of poems that are affixed to or stenciled onto the wood, that are commissioned from poets who are responding to that history and that site and that location.
And those are the architectural elements in there. There's other elements in the show as well, you said, correct?
Yeah, there's a series of smaller scale sculptures that really are dealing with this idea of interconnection and really the connection between American conceptions of freedom, which come up with the revolutionary period, and its contradiction that during the revolutionary period, many of the leading revolutionists held slaves. And in fact, many of the colonists living in New England and all over the northern part of what becomes the United States were able to join the Revolutionary Army because they could leave their slaves behind to run their farms and their homesteads and everything. And so much of the work is about sort of acknowledging that and putting that literally into sculptural form by having these sort of hybridized objects. One of them is a reproduction of Phyllis Wheatley's writing desk, which is bisected by a reproduction of Ralph Waldo Emerson's writing chair. And so the desk literally supports the chair. The chair is sort of integral with the desk. Phyllis Wheatley, probably most of your listeners know, was the first published African-American poet who was brought over to Boston, purchased by the Wheatley family, brought to Boston from Africa, and taught to read and write, taught really a remarkable degree of scholarship, and wrote quite beautiful poetry, which was then published in England. And so, you know, that piece, I think, really highlights the idea of American identity. If the Transcendentalists were really the philosophical and religious underpinnings to this new notion of American identity, of individualism, freedom, liberty, and so forth, it's integral with our history of enslavement and conquest.
That makes sense, and there's other elements in that show too, right? There's also small works on paper that look almost like constellations or
yeah, they're actually prison blankets. So I found a couple of different prison blankets. One of them is brand new from a supply company that supplies prisons. Currently, and a couple of them are more vintage. And affixed on to the blankets are Lincoln pennies arranged in constellations like star maps, and they show the different views of the constellation Ursa Minor, which is the Little Dipper, which includes the North Star, Polaris, which is, of course, such an important and resonant constellation and idea in African American history, the way to freedom, the way north, the navigational, celestial navigational body that so many who ran away and traveled at night would follow. And then, of course, you know, the prison blankets being a kind of nod to the contemporary situation of mass incarceration and the idea that it's an extension of slavery.
And there's a few other elements in there that are also talking about slavery, right? There's a small, and it was because I looked at images from the Blum and Poe site, it looks like something like a small bat on a podium, as well as a broadside about that there are colored people in the area, that there could be, that, you know, slave catchers were seemingly called for. But to talk first about the bat, is that what it is? It looks like a small steel bat.
Yeah, it's a casting of a billy club, actually. And it's a billy club that would have been the type of billy club that would have been used back in the 19th century during the Fugitive Slave Act by self-defense groups to protect themselves, but also to protect escaped slaves who were in Boston seeking, you know, heading north to Canada for freedom. During the Fugitive Slave days, anyone who was aiding or abetting, in fact, anyone who saw a runaway slave or someone they suspected and didn't report it would be guilty of a felony. So it was a very severe thing. But there were many groups in Boston, all over New England, New York, that protected and defended these runaways and refused to use lethal methods. So they wouldn't carry knives or guns. The most they would carry was a billy club. And, the poster itself is a caution colored people of Boston. Watch out for the police. the date on it is 1853 or 54, I think. So, you know, this was shown originally in Massachusetts, and the irony of it, you know, as we've seen in the last years of all the cell phone footage of unarmed black people being shot and killed, beaten to death, choked, whatever, by the police. It's just, it's kind of shocking to think that not much has changed in all this time.
It is. So the politics of this, which, you know, I'd like to get into a little more. I mean, at the moment, I'm kind of immersed in it in my own way. I happen to be in the middle of reading. I mean, it's from kind of an odd vantage point, but all the politics of Lincoln and all his rivals for the presidency and how they were all dealing with the anti-slavery issue or pro-slavery and how divisive it was, but also how, you know, it was a, you know, Lincoln wasn't really for equality. He kept saying all men are created equal, but he wasn't for intermarriage or blacks being on juries or even having citizenship as this book is describing it. So there was a, it's kind of an incredible period you're mining. And like you say, it still seems that it's, you know, the world is somewhat like that now, or so little has changed. So when you mount a show like this at a gallery as prestigious as Blum and Poe, is there a conversation about this? I'm wondering, like, who's collecting it? Is it largely institutions, or are there also individuals that are collecting this work that that appreciate the conversation you're generating?
Yeah. it's a good question, and I mean, I've been doing this kind of work, in the sense work that is sort of explicitly political and often dealing with historical issues like this. With the election of Trump, I think that, you know, suddenly there was a much greater interest in the subject matter of my work, and probably for all artists who are working with more explicitly political subjects in their work, probably the interest has increased. So it was very well received. People were really interested in it, really looking for it, and you know, to some degree, willing to purchase it. You know, I've always struggled in that regard. I've been fortunate to have, you know, enough financial support to get by. But so that's been nice to see that. Institutions generally have been more supportive than private collectors, which, you know, makes sense. And I'm happy about that. I don't think anyone's buying the work for investment purposes, or let's say for purely financial reasons. So I've never really had to worry about that issue, and some artists do, you know, and that would be an issue, I'm sure, for many artists, but not for me. Slowly there's a small number of private collectors, and, you know, the art world, I mean, it's a cliche to say it at this point, but it's so international, it's so globalized that people see, you know, collectors really see everything, and the internet now, it's easy to see what's going on everywhere, which may or may not be a good thing. I don't know. So I also imagine that, you know, I think it used to be when I started out showing in the early 90s, everything was very local, right? I mean, you know, you still had people who flew around the world, but really the ability to see work was really much more local, and that's changed. And so it's added a dimension, I think, wherever I show there, the conversation certainly happens there, but it can also happen all over. And, you know, and that's, I think, you know, been an interesting and helpful thing for me, because the work is often dealing with these difficult things.
Well, and because it's dealing with difficult issues, is it also important to you what collections they end up in terms of, you know, I mean, there's a number of ways to look at that in terms of, you know, who's appreciating them, but who's co-opting them, who's taking them under their wing, and where will they be shown next? I mean, they're as much of their aesthetic pieces, they're also, they're political, they're instructional, they're thought-provoking. So is it important to you what collections they end up in, or is that not something that you're really thinking about? Is that more the gallery?
Well, to be honest, it's not really a problem I have. I mean, you know, in terms of the private side, I'm really not, you know, I've been fortunate that many of the private collectors that have purchased the work are very conscientious about it. They loan it to exhibitions, or, you know, if, for instance, European, the few European collections at private collections, Falkenberg in Germany, or, you know, they have their own buildings and they put the work on view. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know that my work is in any collections that would be, let's say, that would be using the work in ways that are counter to my intentions. Let's put it that way. You know, I guess I would say that. It's not that it couldn't happen. Of course it could. and, you know, if it does, then I'll have to deal with that.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I
I think the reason I ask is, and you know, I don't mean to push that issue, but just, you know, with all the sensitivity to issues these days regarding slavery and the whole Black Lives Matter movement, you know, at Yale there was a recent, you know, renaming of Calhoun College that was really contested, and, you know, and these are kind of like growing pains for institutions everywhere to deal with. How do we, you know, I remember at the point when, you know, with apartheid in South Africa, who's divesting from, you know, investments in South Africa and the movement on campuses to make that happen. So I guess I'm asking it in that kind of context where is there, you know, is that ever something that you run into? But it sounds like no, those kind of collectors probably wouldn't be purchasing this, and that's not something you'd have to be concerned with.
Yeah, I mean, to a degree, I think the work is pretty self-selecting in that way. You know, I think it. Well, I try to maintain a degree of subtlety in the work, I guess, and a kind of a poetic resonance. It's artwork, not propaganda, or even journalism, let's say. And I don't mean to give propaganda, well, propaganda maybe, yeah, but journalism, I'm not saying journalism's bad. You know, we need more of it. But I think there is a difference between journalism and art, you know. So I like to think of it as as not being so in your face, so explicit, that, you know, but then I realize that, you know, what I think of, you know, perhaps as being less explicit, less overt to others is quite strong. So I'm trying to think of an example. I mean, I don't believe I have any work, for instance, in Stephen A. Cohen's collection. You know, then, okay, we might, his business practices, you know, might be an issue, or let's say the Monsanto Corporation, or some, you know, somebody on the board of Monsanto, for instance, where I would have obvious strong disagreements with what they're doing. You know, Monsanto's interesting because they do support a lot of art institutions, mainly in St. Louis. So if a work is collected by an institution in St. Louis, for instance, that is receiving a lot of funding from Monsanto, and that work were to go on view in a Monsanto-funded show, that might be a problem.
Right.
You know, so far, I think that's what you're asking.
That's what I'm asking, and that's interesting. And what are the issue which may be a little stickier of, you know, your gaze is or your approach is a white approach, right? Caucasian approach, as opposed to, if you look at artists like Arthur Jaffa or Ellen Gallagher dealing with also charged political issues, coming from a Black perspective or a biracial perspective. Do you get feedback about that, or what do you think about that issue?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And well, a couple things, you know. Excuse me. One thing that I think is really important is that I'm not claiming this as my identity, so, or my experience. So I'm not speaking from the experience of a person of color, African American, or any other non-white, nor am I speaking for them. I'm speaking from my own experience as a white to a white audience about things that are, I believe, of incredible importance to the so-called, you know, white America, let's say. You know, and I think that, you know, for in the issue around identity-based work, my work is identity-based only in the sense that I try to make my position, you know, clear in the work. And I think, you know, particularly around work that's dealing with race, with African American or Native American history, oppression, et cetera. This is an issue for white society to deal with. We have to deal with it. In fact, it's whites who created the whole notion of race. There is, it's actually a fiction, right? It's, we're the human race. So the notion that we're different is actually an imaginary thing. But it's obviously it's used for political purposes, economic, et cetera.
And also there's politics within the art world itself. I mean, the show that comes to mind is a Pruitt Early show that was at, I don't know if you remember that, it was at Leo Castelli, I think in the 90s. They did a show about, Pruitt Early was a, you know, gay couple that had done a lot of installations about different segments of society, teenagers. And they did this show about Black America, and they were hated for that show, and it kind of literally destroyed their career and a lot of friends, and was seen as racist, and they were kind of confounded as to how that happened. You know, I've interviewed Jack Early a while ago, and you know, they said they'd pore over the interviews, trying to figure out, the reviews, trying to figure out what the hell did we do wrong. And he said, you know, we did a show about teenagers, and they'd say, what do you know about teenagers? You know, you're a gay couple. And he said, you know, it was kind of odd. And so, I mean, in that context, you know, I'm kind of wondering, maybe it's we're seeing things differently now. But I was so surprised at the pushback at that show and how it really kind of destroyed their careers, that, you know, it's if I'm not pressing too much, it also seems, you know, it takes a certain amount of strength to do what you're doing because of the potential of a situation like that.
Yeah, I mean, I do remember that. I didn't see the show, but I remember when that happened. To be honest, it's so hazy in my memory. I'm not sure I could comment, you know, on the particularities of it. My sense is that I don't really know, being in LA, I was in LA at that time, so I don't know who was saying what. If the accusations were coming primarily from whites or from African Americans. I mean, I don't know, because I think, you know, my experience, you know, maybe I should just talk about that, because my experience has been the white, you know, liberal art world has had much more difficulty with the work that I do that deals explicitly with either African American or Native American issues. As far as African American or Native American artists, curators, et cetera, they've been 100% behind it, supportive, enjoyed it, you know, and I think it is a difficult thing because we're still in the point where it's, you know, because the power dynamic, you know, white supremacy still pertains. There's still that power dynamic, and I'm part of the, I benefit from being white. So we're still in a tricky kind of territory, and I really think it depends on how you portray the material. And in a sense, who you are in the work and who your audience is. My audience is really the white audience. I'm doing this primarily for the white audience. Of course, I hope people of color enjoy it, get something out of it. But that's really where the audience is. And I also realize I'm operating in a way that not too many other artists do. I mean, there's an artist named Kendall Gears, who's South African, who lives in, I believe, in Belgium and has for many years, who's always been, you know, kind of an inspiration to me because, you know, as a white artist and doing work about this, about these issues, his work is very confrontational. I don't know if you know his work, but...
Yeah,
it's very intense, and he's been supported very early, going back to the late '80s. Even Aqui and Weser has been a big supporter of his work and organized shows of his work and included him in many things, like the first Johannesburg Biennial and things like that. But yeah, I mean, you know, it is a kind of difficult negotiation. It'd be a lot easier if I were black or indigenous to be doing this kind of work. But I the other thing on the sort of art world politics is the question of the zero-sum game. If I get a show, it means somebody else doesn't. So how many shows are you going to do of an artist who's dealing with these kind of issues of race and politics, you know? And shouldn't it go to an African American artist, you know? And I think that's a tougher one in a way. Maybe there's more and more African American artists active in the art world and highly successful. And that's happened during my career. So I guess I'd like to think that I've been part of that shift as opposed to sort of, you know, taking up space that might have otherwise gone to a non-white artist, you know?
Right. Right. So let's talk about also what you're working on now. This is the show. I'm glad we got into those issues and appreciate you being able to talk about all of that. Then there's what's happening in your studio. You're working on what else at the moment?
Well, one of the things that I'm excited about is the Highline, I don't know what they're calling it, the Highline Sculpture Plinth project that I believe is just announced in the press. They're on the new Highline Spur that crosses 10th Avenue, I think it around 28th, 29th, like something like that. They're going to have a sculpture, rotating, long-term sculpture commission, modeled on the fourth plinth in Trafalgar Square in London. And the selection of finalists was just announced, for the first couple of iterations. And so one of my projects was selected for that, which is the proposal is for to mount a kind of streamlined reproduction of a predator drone on top of a sort of, I don't know, 20-foot pole, basically, and then acting as a kind of wind vane, so kind of rotating as the wind direction changes to point into the wind. So the kind of idea of bringing this aircraft and all of the meanings that it may have on back into the U.S. And you know, it's something that we read about in the news and know about tangentially, but people in other parts of the world know about all too well, and sort of bringing that back home, as it were. So we'll see if that it would certainly be a difficult and risky type of work to do for an organization like the High Line to try.
But you've
and
been selected.
Like
but you've been selected. It sounds like it is going to happen, right?
No. I'm sorry. It's a select. It hasn't been select. There's been a short list, basically. I think there's 10 projects, 10 different projects that have been selected, and the maquettes of the proposals are going to be installed on the High Line coming up soon. I think maybe even next week. And so you'll see the whole range of select, and then from those, 2 projects will be selected.
Well, that's exciting. And so to talk a little bit about that, the Predator drone that sort of is echoes of Obama's legacy in the not too bright side, right? I mean, isn't that was really, it's his presidency that was the drone era assassination policies, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it really came into play under Bush, but Obama expanded it radically, and really expanded this whole notion of the, you know, the kill list, the idea that you know, really that the world is a battlefield. And, you know, I mean, at the legal justification, you know, this idea that the war is literally everywhere and the president and his advisors can decide who lives and dies. And it's a very troubling and important, you know, I think, question for us as a nation to think about and to try and address. But yeah, it was under Obama's, you know, 2 terms that really became a big factor in modern warfare, contemporary warfare.
Yeah, it sure did. It sure did. And seemed to make it seem that he's not really living up to his Nobel Peace Prize laureate status.
Oh, God. Yeah. Well, yeah. There's a, you know, he was an incredible man. There's no doubt. And his presidency, you know, represented so much and yet had some pretty profound failings, for sure. Very, very conflicted, complicated, ambivalent presidency, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Unlike the current one, which I don't think there's any, you know, it's pretty black and white with Donald Trump.
Yeah. So how? I mean, you know, in closing, just in talking about the art. So as we come into this Trump era, you know, there's, how do you think that'll affect your art or just the context of working in this kind of world? I mean, in on one sense, it seems that, boy, you have a lot of material with this presidency, but is it something greater than that? I mean, like you're saying, it's black and white. There's no questioning what's going on here. And it's almost like, I don't know. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but what do you think about these years we're coming into in the context of the work that you make? Does this seem like very rich territory to mine, or do you have a different approach to it, or is that not really your approach?
Yeah, I mean, usually I tend towards working with historical issues, you know, archival things, which would then have a kind of relevance or a resonance with the contemporary situation. So I tend not to work very much on topical things. But who knows, that there's certainly the opportunity there. Like I said, I've been doing this kind of work for a long time. I think, what's been clear is that there's been a resurgence of interest in my work. So since the election, I've gotten a lot more emails, a lot more phone calls. There's certainly, I think people in arts and culture in general are looking for work, looking for artists and producers and, et cetera, across the arts and not just in visual arts, but I think everywhere, that represent a resistance to, what we in the cultural fields, would feel is being attacked, but he said he wanted to end the NEA and the NEH. That's pretty straightforward. That's, war on art, basically.
It sure is.
And I think
it sure is.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of organizations, artist organizations and other, all kinds of cultural organizations, forming, changing their, if they're already existing, institutions are having to face these issues, because they're not going to go away. I mean, it's hard to believe this is only the first month of his presidency, So, the lines have been drawn.
So before we go, I want to ask you the question I ask everyone at the end, which is, would you mind sharing what you're reading now? It could be off topic, anything at all, really.
Well, I tend to do sort of research reading for my work, but then I'm an avid, I love novels, and I read a lot of novels. And this is going to be terrible because I'm not going to remember the author's name, but I just finished a really remarkable novel by a Korean author who's quite well known. The book is about the Gwangju. It's about Gwangju, the Korean, the massacres in the 80s in Gwangju, the repression of the student uprisings, which is really incredible book. And another one,
was the name of that book Human Axe?
Yes.
Han Kang's book?
Yeah.
Han Kang's book, Human Axe. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the other book?
It's about the Cultural Revolution in China, Do Not Say We Have Nothing, by Madeleine Thien, I believe, Canadian novelist. Also really powerful and super relevant for what's going on. We were just talking about Trump's anti-intellectual, anti-cultural plans, and the reading about what happened to people during the Cultural Revolution, cultural producers, teachers, etc., intellectuals, pretty chilling stuff.
Sam, I want to thank you for talking with me today. It's been a pleasure talking about your work and so many of the issues surrounding it. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it, Brandon.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.